Wondery Plus subscribers can listen to Tides of History early and ad-free right now. Join Wondery Plus in the Wondery app or Apple Podcasts.
Hi, everybody. Patrick here. So, we've done a few episodes of Tides over the years on pandemics, Black Death, the Justinianic Plague, and so on. Since we are currently living through a pandemic, the coronavirus meets all of the definitions, I wanted to revisit these old episodes and put them back out there for you to listen to. Now, let's be clear about this. The coronavirus is not the bubonic plague. I'm not saying that it is. Let's get that straight. But it's worth trying to wrap our heads around what the worst-case scenarios were like, how the disease spread, what it was like to live through it, and, most important of all, what the consequences were. As Mark Twain put it, history doesn't repeat itself, but it does rhyme. So, with that in mind, here's our episode on the Justinianic Plague. An icy, unseasonably cold March wind cut through the villagers' worn woolen clothing. Two dozen people stood clustered around the edge of an open pit dug out of the fertile soil of the Tiber River Valley in central Italy. The villagers bowed their heads in prayer as a priest read out a blessing, the sound mixing with gentle sobbing and lamentation amid the howling wind. The pit was a mass grave. Inside were the remains of a dozen people who died in an outbreak of a terrible disease in the last 2 weeks. The bodies in the grave represented a full quarter of the village. All around the pit, mounds of freshly turned soil marked the places where the disease's first victims had been buried. Now, there were just too many for individual plots. The only way to handle the sheer magnitude of the disaster was with a mass grave. The year was 543. And the bubonic plague had made its first appearance in Europe. This plague of Justinian was just one of a series of catastrophes that marked the end of the ancient world and the beginning of the medieval. At the same time as plague was ravaging villages like this one, the climate was cooling. Harvests failed. People starved. A terrible war between the invading Romans and the Ostrogoths was entering its seventh year. It would continue for another 11. War, pestilence, and famine, three of the four horsemen of the apocalypse, rode together into Italy. Today, we'll find out how they interacted and reinforced each other, producing the transition between antiquity and the medieval world. Villagers like these, real people, were the victims of this confluence of disaster. Their lives and their deaths marked that transition. From Wondery, this is Tides of History. I'm Patrick Wyman. Thank you for joining me today. The reign of the great Emperor Justinian between 527 and 565 was a turning point. He codified Roman law, launched an enormous building program, and reconquered North Africa, Italy, and part of Spain. Under his rule, an ideological program of imperial renewal disguised deep transformations of the empire and what it meant to be Roman. Justinian and his propagandists presented all of this as a return to an idealized past. In fact, it was something drastically new. But that's not the only reason Justinian's reign marked a turning point. More than Gothic armies, raiding Moors, or invading Persians, the forces of nature struck hard at Justinian's empire. The climate had been getting worse for a long time. It finally reached its worst point during Justinian's reign. Harvests failed. Famine ravaged entire regions. If that weren't enough, pandemics struck the empire beginning in 541. Millions died in this first great outbreak of the bubonic plague. By the time the dust settled, it was clear that the world had changed. There were fewer people, smaller or non-existent cities, and a less developed economy. Those natural catastrophes and how they interacted with man-made disasters like war are what we'll explore here today. When we talk about concepts or periods of history, antiquity, the Middle Ages, modernity, and so on, it's never a neutral description of objective facts. There's always an argument to be made about what defines a particular time and place, about what kinds of changes really matter in the grand scheme of things. We have to pick and choose and arrange our facts and evidence in some kind of order. At worst, that process can be an unconscious reflection of our worst biases. At best, it's a sustained, coherent, and nuanced argument. The best way to make an argument for periodization, in my opinion, is to find a stretch of time where a whole bunch of things seem to be changing all at once. It could be politics, social structure, culture, religion, the economy, war, or climate and disease. In Justinian's reign, that 38-year stretch between 527 and 565, we find a whole bunch of things shifting in major ways very quickly. Last week, we talked in depth about some of those things. The political map of the Mediterranean shifted in major ways as Justinian's empire reconquered large chunks of its lost territory, namely North Africa and Italy. More importantly, his reign both reflected and helped to drive a huge shift in how people thought about their political world. The idea of reconquest would have seemed strange to people a few decades earlier, around the end of the 5th century. Reconquest implies that something had been lost. Most folks weren't really thinking in those terms. There was really no concept of a fall of the Roman Empire, of some serious breakage with the past, until Justinian's reign took an idea that had been floating around Constantinople and popularized it. The first text to use 476, Romulus Augustulus's deposition, as the date for the end of the Roman Empire was written by a Count Marcellinus. Marcellinus was a member of the inner circle of Justinian's court. According to its official propaganda, Justinian's empire represented the restoration of a lost thing. It was perfect, united, whole, a reflection of God's will in the form of a political unit led by a semi-divine emperor. This whole package, when you put it all together, amounted to something fundamentally new. This is what we talked about last week. But the simultaneous changes in the natural world and the effects they produced on the human world far outweighed any shifts in the political landscape. Moreover, those changes in the natural world interacted both with each other and with those changes in the political landscape. As I mentioned earlier, war, pestilence, and famine are three of the four horsemen of the apocalypse. They ride together. One quick note before we get going. You should listen to all of today's episode with a citation in mind. I'm drawing heavily on a recent book by Kyle Harper called The Fate of Rome: Climate, Disease, and the End of Empire. It's an extraordinary piece of work, one of the best I've ever read on the fall of the Roman Empire. I usually don't rely so heavily on one work, but this is so good, so recent, and so relevant, it's unavoidable. We'll actually be talking to Professor Harper here on Tides of History in a few weeks, so we can pick his brain on all of this. But for today, just keep that mental footnote in mind. So let's start with climate. We're not talking here about anthropogenic or man-made climate change in the last couple of centuries. Instead, we're talking about the kinds of shifts in the Earth's climate that take place regularly on multiple timescales. For example, we're currently in the midst of a glacial period known as the Quaternary Glaciation that began about 2.58 million years ago. We know this because there are ice caps at both poles, which isn't the case in non-glacial periods. Within this larger glacial period, we're currently in a subdivision known as the Late Holocene. Within this period, there have been times of colder and warmer weather that affect the entire planet. Within those times of colder and warmer weather, there have been regionally specific patterns of warmth or coolness, wetness, and drought. It might shift toward cooler and drier in one spot and warmer and wetter in another simultaneously. To make a very, very long story short, climate is a complicated thing that shifts on timescales that range from individual years to millions of years. Kyle Harper put it best, quote, "Late Holocene climate change has been like a carousel, moving in different directions at different speeds simultaneously. Even relatively short-term shifts have massive impacts. They're even more pronounced, even more important, when societies live closer to the rhythms of agricultural life. That was the case in the late Roman world, and it's a major contrast with our world today. Imagine we're not just talking about weather, which is going to vary naturally from year to year. Imagine you're used to a particular climate regime, a certain range of rainfall at certain times of the year combined with a certain range of temperatures. These conditions set limits on what crops you can grow, when you can plant them, when you can harvest them, how much yield you can expect. You make your choices on the basis of those conditions, and you expect your variation within those limits. Stability and predictability are key to agriculture. Today, with commercial farming, that's mostly about profit margins. In past societies, though, it was about survival. People lived closer to the edge. When the climate conditions that dictate everything from choice of crop to expected yield shift dramatically in a short period of time, you're in huge trouble. That's exactly what happened beginning in the 3rd century AD. The climate started to cool off and dry out. These long-term processes culminated in the mid-530s, precisely when Justinian's armies and the Goths were teaming up to ravage Italy. But hold on just a second. If the climate had been cooling for a few centuries by the 530s, what had it been like before? The answer to that question contains some real insights into why the Roman Empire prospered so much in the first couple of centuries AD. The peak of the Roman Empire coincides with a period of climate history known as the Roman Climatic Optimum, or occasionally, the Roman Warm Period. The boundaries of this set of conditions are hard to suss out. Estimates range between 550 BC and 350 AD at the most extreme. But there's a good argument to be made for roughly 200 BC to 150 AD, and that's what we're going to use here. So what was the Roman climatic optimum? Well, in the most basic sense, it was a warm, wet, and above all, stable period of climate. The sun's activity varies over time from high to low. Higher activity means higher average temperatures. Lower activity means lower temperatures on a global scale. In the Roman climatic optimum, solar activity was high throughout the whole period. Volcanic activity is another relatively short-term influence on climate. An eruption ejects particulate matter into the atmosphere. A big enough eruption is enough to limit the amount of sunlight reaching the Earth. That happened in 1816, for example. The eruption of Mount Tambora that year threw so much matter into the atmosphere that summer just never came around. That's something we'll come back to later today. Now, it's noteworthy that none of the largest eruptions of the last two millennia took place during the Roman climatic optimum. Conditions were wetter, too, often by a substantial margin. In Italy, for example, conditions were qualitatively different than they are today. There was a great deal more rain in the summer and much more flooding in the spring and summer. More of North Africa was wet enough to be fertile. Areas that are desert today hold evidence of Roman agriculture from two millennia ago. The Romans had the capital to invest in large-scale irrigation projects, too. So not only were conditions naturally wetter, the Romans could harness those wet conditions and put them to use in the agricultural landscape. This was true beyond the empire's borders, too. Today, southwestern Libya is an impossibly arid piece of the Sahara Desert. In this period, it was home to an advanced civilization known as the Garamantes. In the Levant, the Dead Sea was much higher than it is today. All of this adds up to a climate that was perfectly suited for an agricultural explosion. The olive and the grape, the quintessential Mediterranean products, could be grown well outside their current range. In Roman Greece, there were olive presses built at altitudes that won't sustain olive cultivation today. You don't haul olives up the hillside to press them. The only reasonable explanation is that you could grow olives there during this period. In general, mountainous areas that are too cold and dry for wheat production today were thriving agricultural regions during this period. Kyle Harper estimates that in hilly Italy alone, a temperature rise of 1 degree Celsius would make an additional 5 million hectares available for cultivation. That's enough land to feed 3 or 4 million people. We already mentioned it, but a wetter climate made much more of the North African coastline productive than today. More arable, fertile land meant that you could sustain far more people. Conditions were ripe for an explosion. Lo and behold, that's exactly what we see. The period from Augustus to Marcus Aurelius, roughly 27 BC to 180 AD, is known today as the Pax Romana, the Roman Peace. It's traditionally thought to be the high point of Roman civilization. That isn't just a product of looking back with rose-colored glasses. The population really did increase by an enormous amount. The productivity of the economy rose drastically. There was real growth both in sum and per capita. The average person's standard of living was higher than it had ever been before, or would be again until the early modern period, if not later. The favorable climate alone didn't produce this. Human agency worked hand in hand with natural conditions. Political structures, economic institutions, social organization, and above all trade reinforced the possibilities for growth offered by the favorable climate. But it couldn't last forever. Starting around the middle of the second century, things started to get worse. It got drier and colder. Even worse would follow. For centuries, the Roman world showed off tremendous resilience in the face of changing climatic conditions. Eventually, it would prove to be too much. That time came during the reign of Justinian.
If you travel, you know when it comes to love.
See you soon.
Can't wait.
The sky is no limit. You know with your Delta Amex card, being oceans apart means meeting in Aruba. And booking a war travel with your card means saving 15% on Delta flights. You know kissing under the bridge of sighs guarantees eternal love. Because you're the long-distance lovebirds. It's why you're a Delta SkyMiles Platinum American Express card member. If you travel, you know. Take off 15 discount not applicable to partner-operated flights or taxes and fees. Terms apply. Visit go.amex/you know.
We humans aren't prisoners of natural conditions. That idea is called environmental determinism. It's almost as bad as assuming the environment is an unchanging constant that we don't need to think about at all. What climate does is it sets limits. It drives responses from people. But human agency plays an enormous role in determining what those responses are. Resilient societies can withstand climatic and other kinds of shocks. They'll adjust where they live, the kinds of crops they grow. Their political systems will change. They may collect less in tax or different kinds of tax. They might adjust and operate with a lighter or heavier hand depending on the circumstances. Some societies weather these climatic shifts. Others don't. This is why you need to be wary when you read a headline like, "Climate Change Brought Down the Maya." It wasn't climate change, it was the inadequacy of the response. In technical terms, the extent to which societies can absorb these shocks is called resilience. Beginning around the middle of the 2nd century AD, the Roman climatic optimum started to give way to something less favorable. Scholars call what replaced these favorable conditions the late Roman transition. It was drier, cooler, and above all, much less stable from year to year or decade to decade. Solar activity was lower. There were major volcanic eruptions. The first really bad signs start to appear in the 240s. Drought racked North Africa and Palestine. The annual flooding of the Nile in Egypt grew more variable. Worse and more destructive in some years, almost non-existent in others. Egypt was the breadbasket of the Roman world. Its incredibly high and predictable grain production provided a buffer for the rest of the empire in case of famine, along with a huge amount of tax revenue. At this key moment, the buffer failed. It's not a coincidence that this period of extremely variable and unfavorable climate coincided with the worst parts of the crisis of the 3rd century. For a period of a few decades, the empire was very nearly on the edge of falling apart completely. Ambitious generals repeatedly tried to usurp the throne. Civil war was constant. Barbarian invaders and raiders swamped the frontiers over and over again. The economy nearly collapsed. A vast and underappreciated pandemic, probably either especially virulent influenza or a hemorrhagic virus like Ebola, killed millions of people. By the 260s, the empire had actually splintered into three separate states. You can see how all of these different pieces would play together. Poor climatic conditions meant bad harvests. Bad harvests meant outright famine in some places, a less healthy population that was less resistant to disease, and lower tax revenues for the state. Pandemic killed millions of people whose productivity contributed to the economy, along with a great many of the soldiers guarding the frontiers. The Roman Empire's resources and capacities were stretched to the breaking point and beyond. It took a Herculean effort from a series of capable emperors to put things back together again, but eventually they were able to put it back. In a basic sense, the empire showed off its resilience. The 4th century was a time of recovery for the Roman Empire. Competent emperors reigned for long periods with the help of new and highly effective military and bureaucratic institutions. The climate was a big part of that strong recovery. It got warmer and wetter again, lasting until around 450. It was favorable, though more unstable than the Roman climatic optimum had been. On the other hand, the repeated disasters that hit the Roman Empire in the first half of the 5th century should remind us that a generally favorable climate doesn't guarantee broader societal or political stability. Around 450, the climate started to shift in a negative direction again. It grew more unstable, setting the stage for the natural event that would define Justinian's reign, the onset of the late antique Little Ice Age. Whew, that's a mouthful. What exactly does it mean? Well, it marks the onset of a much colder period than what had come before. 536 AD was a year without a summer, and it kicked off a serious climatic downturn. Just a few years later, plague would follow on its heels. To cap it all off, Justinian's devastating warring reinforced the effects of these natural disasters. The result was the tipping point, the period of rapid, meaningful change that we talked about earlier. To help us understand what that meant in practice, we're going to follow the experiences of a family of common folk in Italy throughout this period. These are composite characters I've put together, mostly from the archaeological record. Through their eyes, we'll try to grasp what it meant to live through climatic anomalies, plague, and the ceaseless wars of Justinian's reign. Let's meet this family in the year 535. They live on an estate about 25 miles to the north of Rome, in the rich agricultural land of the Tiber Valley, where the river snakes down out of the Apennines toward the great city. This estate is the property of an elderly Gothic noble named Sunna. It's one of several he owns. It's been in his family since the 490s, when it was granted to him by the Ostrogothic King Theodoric. The centerpiece of the estate is a magnificent villa that has been built and rebuilt over the centuries. It has its own bathhouse, storehouses, and blacksmith's forge. The floors are fine mosaic, and the walls are decorated with gorgeous frescoes. Sunna had added his own stamp with a pair of towers and a wall that looked like they belonged on a frontier fort. He said they were for defense, but really they were just to remind everybody who looked at the villa that the Gothic nobleman who owned it was a warrior, not some soft-handed Roman aristocrat. Our family doesn't live in this fancy villa, though. The five of them, two adults and three children, live in a one-room hut. It's one of a dozen homes that cluster around the main house of the villa and form a small village of around 60 people. The folks who live in these huts are tied to the land. They're not slaves, they can't be bought and sold, but they're not entirely free either. They can't leave the estate without permission, and they're subject to harsh penalties if they do. In return for working the land, they pay a hefty rent to the owner of the estate. The estate is simultaneously a self-contained island and connected deeply to the world beyond. On the slopes of the hills around the villa, the workers tend vines and press the grapes into wine at a press in the villa. There are groves of olive trees and a press for the olives as well. But those are fairly minor crops for them and new ones. It's because it's gotten harder to import olive oil from Spain or North Africa and wine from Greece, but a few people in the village still have fine red pottery fired outside Carthage. A century before, the estate grew only wheat, mostly for export to Rome. That's still the main crop now. This estate is still a cog in an advanced economy based around regional specialization. It's geared toward commercial agriculture for sale on the market, not subsistence farming. The matriarch of the family is named Thecla. She makes rough-hewn pottery and weaves wool cloth from the sheep the estate owns. Her husband, Petrus, mostly works in the wheat fields. They have three teenaged children, two girls and one boy, who are nearing adulthood. To them, it doesn't make much difference whether their estate's owned by a Gothic nobleman or a Roman aristocrat. Life goes on, as it has for generations. They have fewer imported goods, maybe. Maybe they pay a little bit less in rent to the estate owner, but otherwise, not much has changed. Thecla and Petrus and their family live according to the rhythms of planting, harvesting, and in general, seasonal work. The harvest of 535 had been a bountiful one. The year's chilly, but that seems to be the direction things are heading. Petrus and Thecla had mentioned to each other the last spring that it felt colder than it had been when they were children a few decades before. The weather was more unpredictable, too. Still, they had pulled in a good crop with plenty of excess holed up in the grain stores on the estate. The winter of 535 is even colder, and so were the first couple of months of 536. In March of that year, something very strange happens. The sun seems to falter and grow weak. Here's how the historian Procopius, who was in Italy that year, not far from our friends Petrus and Thecla, describes it. Quote, "The sun gave forth its light without brightness, like the moon, and it seemed extremely like the sun in eclipse, for the beams it emitted were not clear like those it usually makes." This wasn't a momentary phenomenon. It lasted for a full 18 months. The culprit was an enormous volcanic eruption somewhere in the northern hemisphere. We're not sure precisely which volcano it was. The sun was already entering a period of low activity, and the ejection of so much material into the atmosphere blocked what little sunlight was coming. It was the perfect storm of factors all meeting at the same time. Because of all this, summer never came in 536. According to a variety of proxy markers for temperature, including tree ring series and ice cores, 536 was the coldest year in the last two millennia in the Northern Hemisphere. It was a full 2.5 degrees Celsius colder than average. As you can expect, this was terrible for agriculture. The wheat harvest failed completely. The wine pressed from that year's grapes was undrinkable. Thecla and Petrus aren't stupid. They're aware of how bad things are. They have enough grain holed up from last year's harvest to wait out the winter, but it'll be tight. Nobody in the village will go to sleep with a full belly. Another bad harvest the next year, though, will mean starvation. The failed harvest is just the beginning of their problems. A trader from Rome had shown up at the estate earlier in 536. He brought the news that a Roman army from the east had landed in Italy. Elderly Sunna, the estate owner, had ridden out with his sons and the other Goths living in the area to join the army to repel them. A courier passing through later in the year tells them that the Romans had put Naples to the sword. The army is headed north for Rome itself. The year without a summer turns into a frigid, icy fall. In November, they hear that the Roman army has captured the city of Rome. The Goths ran without a fight. A week afterward, the first Roman patrol shows up. Well, not really Roman. The horsemen are barbarian Huns from beyond the frontier, serving in the army of the great general Belisarius. Thecla and Petrus, along with the rest of the villagers, are afraid the Huns will take the meager supplies of grain they'll need to survive the coming winter. Their village gets lucky. The Huns leave without taking anything. But they hear other villages in the region aren't so fortunate. The winter is a brutal one, the coldest anybody can remember. Thecla, Petrus, and their three children are relatively fit and healthy. They make it through the winter thinner and freezing, but alive. The very young, the elderly, and the sick in their village are especially vulnerable. A few don't survive. The sun is still weak, its rays barely warming the hills surrounding the Tiber Valley. Thecla and Petrus aren't especially devout, but they wonder whether God is punishing them, and what they and the rest have done to deserve this. Little do they know, this is just the beginning of their troubles.
If you travel for work, you know to pack two suits, business and swim. You know with your Delta SkyMiles Business Amex card, buying that plane ticket for a business trip can get you closer to medallion status. You know that a meeting in Montana means visiting almost every national park.
Yellowstone? Check.
Because you're the chief excursion officer, It's why you're a Delta SkyMiles Platinum Business American Express card member. If you travel, you know. Terms apply. Visit go.amex/you-know-business.
Do you ever wonder where all your money went? Like every single time you look at your bank account? Honestly, it's probably all those subscriptions. I felt that way too, until I got Rocket Money. Rocket Money helped me see all the subscriptions I'm paying for, and it was eye-opening. Between streaming services, fitness apps, delivery services, it all adds up so quickly. Rocket Money is a personal finance app that finds and cancels your unwanted subscriptions, monitors your spending, and helps lower your bills. Rocket Money has over 5 million users and has helped save its members an average of $720 a year, with over 500 million in canceled subscriptions. Stop wasting money on things you don't use. Cancel your unwanted subscriptions by going to rocketmoney.com/Wondery. That's rocketmoney.com/Wondery. rocketmoney.com/Wondery.
.537 is warmer than .536 had been, but it's still unnaturally cold. Thekla and Petrus try to get back to something like normal life, but the village seems less lively. Everyone is thin and hungry. As they sow their wheat in the spring, they get the news that the Goths are coming to besiege Rome. This is bad news. A siege means that army will need food, and where will they get it if not from villages like theirs? Sure enough, a band of Goths led by one of their estate owner's sons shows up in April, looking for supplies. They carry off a few sheep and half of what little grain is left. One of the respected older men in the village tries to protest, and the leader of the Goths cuts him down where he stands as a warning to the rest. Finally, the sun starts to shine more brightly as summer turns into fall and the harvest comes around. It's not a good harvest, especially not by the standards they'd been used to, but it's still better than the failure of 536. Knowing that the Goths are still besieging Rome and they'll be back to collect part of the harvest, the villagers hide their seed for the next year in a cave in the hills near the estate. The Goths show up again just after harvest. They take most of the grain, the meager amount of drinkable wine, and most of the olive oil. When a woman protests that they'll have nothing to eat for the winter, she too falls victim to a Goth's sword. The winter of 537 to 538 is milder than the last had been, but there was even less food. They were all worn down by more than a year of meager rations. Half a dozen people die, including the last of the elderly and the infants who'd been born in the preceding year. There are no children under the age of 5 left, victims of poor nutrition, depressed immune systems, and the constant cold. The villagers slaughter the last of their skinny sheep, and that keeps them going through the worst months. That means no more wool to weave into cloth for sale on the market, though. There had been 60 people in their village in 535. Now, it was 50. In the spring, Thekla and Petrus hear that old Sunna and his sons were all killed in the siege of Rome. They wouldn't be returning, and the Gothic army was retreating in a shambles to the north of Italy. Roman soldiers came through in the summer, but there's no grain for them to take. It's all in the ground. Luckily for the villagers, that year's harvest is a decent one, and so was the next. The winters aren't as bad, though they're still cold. With the Goths in the north and the Romans chasing them, they're left to their own devices. With the estate owner dead and gone and nobody claiming his property, there's no rent to pay. The land they work becomes communal. The villagers acquire a few sheep to replace the ones they've lost, and they plant more olive trees. Tentatively, Thekla and Petrus, their children, and a few other villagers move from their huts into the villa house itself. It's warmer, and it has high walls and the towers for protection. In 540, though, it starts to get colder again. Much colder. We know now that an enormous volcanic eruption somewhere in the tropics is to blame. Thekla and Petrus have no idea about any of that. They just know that it's colder and the year's wheat crop will be disastrously short of what they'll need. Because of that, it's yet another hard winter. One of their children catches the flu and isn't strong enough to fight off the infection. He's not the only one in the village to die. Healthy adults, their bodies racked by years of malnutrition and stress, are dying younger as well. 541 is better, but still a bad year. Thekla and Petrus are starting to wonder whether it will ever warm up again, and whether their once bountiful harvests will ever return to their old productivity. There are fewer people to feed now. Only 45 remain in the village, where there were 60 6 years before. The Goths and Romans are gone, at least for the time being. The villagers don't have an immediate overlord, and now all of them are living within the walls of the villa. The bathhouse doesn't function anymore, but it's far more comfortable and safer than their old huts. The villagers hear less about the distant world than they used to. They used to deal regularly with merchants coming up the road from Rome, and the estate owners were always closely tied into what was happening in the city. But with no real surplus grain and little cloth to sell, the villagers are increasingly disconnected from commercial markets. Rome is just 25 miles away, but the city was hollowed out by the year-long siege and famines of the past few years. The elites are mostly gone. Still, one piece of news reaches them late in 542. A great pestilence has broken out in the cities of the east. Early in 543, the disease reaches the villagers. It hits Rome first, and refugees fleeing the mortality in the city bring it to their village. They have no idea what causes it or how it spreads, but it tears through them in a matter of weeks. First comes a mild but persistent fever. Then swellings appear, usually in the groin, but also in the armpits or on the thighs or neck. Death follows shortly after. Within weeks, half of the villagers left are dead. This was the Justinianic Plague, the first great outbreak of bubonic plague in the West. We're far more familiar with the Black Death of the 14th century. That's something we'll be talking about at great length a few months down the road. The bacterium responsible for bubonic plague is called Yersinia pestis, and it's a nasty little guy. It lives in fleas that are hosted by small rodents and especially rats. Rats are our constant companions, and fleas are theirs. This means plague doesn't necessarily rely on humans for transmission. Scholars have argued a lot about this. Human-borne fleas can transmit the disease, and it can be transmitted directly between people, but those aren't the primary vectors for infection. Something like smallpox, which relies on human vectors, burns through cities extremely quickly, but dissipates when it hits less populated ground in rural areas. Plague, on the other hand, is just as lethal in the countryside. Rats love rural grain stores just as much as they love urban ones. The Justinianic Plague isn't nearly as well documented as the Black Death 800 years later. We can trace the spread of the Black Death day by day from town to town in exacting detail. With the Justinianic Plague, we're lucky to have a one-line mention that plague came to Iberia or Italy or Ireland in some particular year. Even combining all the textual sources in Latin, Greek, Syriac, and several other languages leaves us with only a scattered record. This is why we failed to see just how devastating it really was. Until about a decade ago, when a scholar named Lester Little put together a volume with a bunch of different contributions, there wasn't even a single comprehensive treatment of the subject. But now, thanks to some really fantastic historical and archaeological work, we're starting to see just how bad the Justinianic Plague really was. The Harvard historian Michael McCormick tracked mass graves dating to this period in exacting detail over the last few years. He found dozens of them. A group of scientists sequenced the genome of the plague bacterium from one of those mass graves. They confirmed that it was, in fact, Yersinia pestis. These years of sustained work have produced a really stunning reappraisal of the Justinianic Plague. The conclusion is simple. It was every bit as bad as the Black Death. Like the later plague, it stuck around for centuries after its initial outbreak. Literally millions of people died. If it was anywhere near as lethal as the Black Death, and there's no good reason to think it wasn't, between 40 and 60% of the population might have died in the initial outbreak. The disease didn't go away after that first wave of plague either. Additional outbreaks hit Constantinople 7 more times between 558 and 749. There were at least 5 more in Italy in that same stretch. All of this meant that the population fell off a cliff and then stayed low. It never got a chance to recover. Return to our friends Thecla and Petrus and the rest of the villagers and try to understand what this meant in practice. This brings us all the way back around to the folks we encountered at the beginning of this episode, the villagers standing around the mass grave. Their community has already been rocked by war, by the cooling weather, by terrible food shortages. Now, the population is barely a third of what it had been in 535, just 8 years before. It's impossible for us to understand what that meant in human terms. Practically overnight, half of the already reduced population is gone. Things didn't get better either. The weather stays cold for another couple of years. The decade between 536 and 535 was the coldest of the past two millennia. If that weren't enough, Gothic and Roman armies swept up and down the Italian peninsula, capturing and recapturing Rome and other cities. Thecla, Petrus, and their remaining daughter grow used to running and hiding in the hills when soldiers from either side come through. They lose whole harvests to these depredations. In desperation, a few of the younger men try to leave to find work or join one of the armies. They never return. By 554, when the Gothic War finally wound down and the Romans had established control over the peninsula, what they took over was a smoldering wreck. Barely 15 people still live in Thecla and Petrus's village, a quarter of the population back in 535. Few of the children born in the past two decades have survived. Hard times always hit the young and the old the hardest. Some of the villages and estates around them had simply disappeared. It's still cold, far colder than it had been a century before, and the harvests just aren't as abundant. Trade networks had been shattered and cities had emptied. Perhaps 30 or 40,000 people still live in Rome, if even that. It's maybe a tenth of the city's population a century before. For those who survived, though, life would slowly start to get better. Land was cheap and available for use. Farmers diversified from wheat to other crops. They raised more livestock. The diets of even common people improved substantially. The death or absence of landowners meant that folks like Thecla and Petrus may have had more autonomy and self-determination, at least for a while. Paradoxically, the plague benefited the survivors. Somehow, though, I doubt they would have traded the lives of their friends and family for whatever benefits came after. On the whole, these two decades were a disaster. Italy is just the strongest example of a phenomenon that hit all across what had been the Roman world. The historian Brian Ward Perkins estimates that the population of Italy was reduced to half or even a quarter of what it had been, and I tend toward the lower end of that estimate. The archaeologist Neil Christie sums it up, quote, "People are so much harder to recognize after circa 550. Their way of life grew simpler, with fewer imported objects and thin trade networks connecting them to the outside world. But there were also just fewer people to recognize, period. It wasn't just plague or climate or war that did this. It was all three working together. Harvests got worse. Malnutrition made people more vulnerable to disease. War destroyed infrastructure. It disrupted trade that might have mitigated famines by moving food from one place to another. Soldiers on the move helped to spread plague. They requisitioned foodstuffs that might have saved communities on the brink. There were long-term factors at play here, but the real meat of the action happened in the space of half a lifetime or less. If we're looking for a time of transition, if we're looking for a turning point between the Roman world and what came after, I don't think we can do any better than Justinian's reign. He thought he was restoring something to its past perfection, but really, he was inaugurating something entirely new. We talked earlier about resilience, about how societies can respond to shocks. In Justinian's time, the Roman world hit its breaking point. Finally, it snapped. That snap marks the transition between antiquity and the Middle Ages. When we return next month, we'll be heading forward in time to the early modern period. We'll be discussing the Renaissance, the cultural efflorescence in art and learning that upended the world of the Middle Ages. When we come back to Rome in February, we'll be wrapping up this portion of the series with a pair of episodes on what it means to talk about the fall of the Roman Empire and why it matters. Thank you so much for joining me for today's episode. Be sure and drop me a line if you'd like to talk about the fall of the Roman Empire or the rise of the modern world. You can find me on Twitter at @Patrick_Wyman or on Facebook at @PatrickWymanMMA. You can follow the show at Tides History. If you haven't already, don't forget to subscribe to Tides of History on Apple Podcasts, NPR One, Stitcher, and everywhere else you get your podcasts. If you've been enjoying the show, I'd really appreciate it if you left a 5-star rating and review. Tides of History is written and narrated by me, Patrick Wyman. The sound designer is Jeff Schmidt. The sound engineer is Sergio Enriquez. From Wondery, the executive producers are Ben Adair and Hernan Lopez. The associate producer is Leah Sutherland. Thanks again for listening. Until next time, from Wondery, this has been Tides of History.
You know, if I would have applied myself, I could have gone to the NBA.
You think so?
Yeah, I think so. But it's just like, it's been done. You know, I didn't want to, I was like, I don't want to be a follower. Hi, I'm Jason Concepcion.
And I'm Shea Serrano. And we are back. We have a new podcast from Wondery. It's called Six Trophies.
Woo!
And it's the f***ing best.
Each week, Shea Serrano and I are combing through all the NBA storylines, finding the best, most interesting, most compelling stories, and then handing out six pop culture-themed trophies for six basketball-related activities.
Trophies like the Dominic Toretto, I Live My Life a Quarter Mile at a Time trophy, which is given to someone who made a short-term decision with no regard for future consequence.
Or the Christopher Nolan Tenet trophy, which is given to someone who did something that we didn't understand.
Catalina Wine Mixer trophy.
Ooh, the Lauryn Hill, you might win some, but you just lost one trophy. And what's more, the NBA playoffs are here, so you want to make Six Trophies your go-to companion podcast through all the craziness. Follow Six Trophies on the Wondery app or wherever you get your podcasts. Listen ad-free right now by joining Wondery Plus.